Hello, Park Street. Welcome back. Today is day 24 of our journey through Lent in the Book of John. Today, I am happy to have three wonderful guests with me, Reed Courtney, Alec Dunlap, and Gabby Ader, and they are all students at the Ashland University. I just want to have them kind of introduce themselves and talk about how they got to Ashland, where they're from, what they're studying, what they're doing. So, Reed, would you go ahead and go first?
Yeah, absolutely. What's up, Park Street? My name's Reed. I actually interned at Park Street for a whole year, which is a really awesome time. But yeah, I came to AU really out of a financial decision. It was just a cheaper school than others. But then, like, I really kind of got plugged into the Christian community in town. And really kind of saw what God's plan was for me in Ashland. Yeah, I studied political science, trying to stay around Ashland next year, but looking like I'm probably going to end up in Columbus working for the state legislature, so.
Cool.
I'm Alec Dunlap. I'm from Defiance, Ohio, born and bred. I came to Ashland because I felt a call to ministry. And so my pastor recommended I go to Ashland, and I said, okay, and I went to Ashland. I'm a sophomore studying religion, and yeah, that's me.
I'm Gabby. I'm from Washington Courthouse, Ohio. I visited Ashland my senior year of high school, didn't really have any plans of actually coming here, and then I fell in love with the school. I felt like that's where God was calling me, so... Here I am.
Here we are. I appreciate you guys. I've got a chance to know the three of them through kind of their service through Young Life here in Ashland County, which is how we got to know each other. Tess and I have been on the committee with Young Life for 5 or 6 years, and so as part of that, we've gotten to know kind of college leaders, and, you know, it's been fun. You guys are awesome, and we really enjoy getting to spend time with you, and thank you for agreeing to do an episode or two here. So today's episode is John chapter 11, starting with verse 45, and we're actually going to be reading kind of two sections. The other section is John chapter 12 through verse 11. So Alec has agreed to read these sections, and let's hear it.
Okay. Therefore, many of the Jews who had come to visit Mary and had seen what Jesus did believed in him. But some of them went to the Pharisees and told them what Jesus had done. Then the chief priests and the Pharisees called a meeting of the Sanhedrin. What are we accomplishing? They asked. Here is this man performing many signs. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him, and then the Romans will come and take away both our temple and our nation. Then one of them, named Caiaphas, who was high priest that year, spoke up. You know nothing at all. You do not realize it is better for you that one man die for the people than that the whole nation perish. He did not say this on his own, but as a high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the Jewish nation, and not only for that nation, but also for the scattered children of God, to bring them together and to make them one. So from that day on, they plotted to take his life. Therefore, Jesus no longer moved about publicly among the people of Judea. Instead, he withdrew to a region near the wilderness, to a village called Ephraim, where he stayed with his disciples. When it was almost time for the Jewish Passover, many went up from the country to Jerusalem for their ceremonial cleansing before the Passover. They kept looking for Jesus. And as they stood in the temple courts, they asked one another, "What do you think? Isn't he coming to the festival at all?" But the chief priests and the Pharisees had given orders that anyone who found out where Jesus was should report it so that they might arrest him. 6 days before the Passover, Jesus came to Bethany, where Lazarus lived, whom Jesus had raised from the dead. Here a dinner was given in Jesus' honor. Martha served while Lazarus was among those reclining at the table with him. Then Mary took a pint of pure nard, an expensive perfume. She poured it on Jesus' feet and wiped his feet with her hair. And the house was filled with the fragrance of the perfume. But one of his disciples, Judas Iscariot, who was later to betray him, objected. Why wasn't this perfume sold and the money given to the poor? It was worth a year's wages. He did not say this because he cared about the poor, but because he was a thief. As keeper of the money bag, he used to help himself to what was put into it. Leave her alone, Jesus replied. It was intended that she should save this perfume for the day of my burial. You will always have the poor among you, but you will not always have me. Meanwhile, a large crowd of Jews found out that Jesus was there and came, not only because of him, but also to see Lazarus, whom he had raised from the dead. So the chief priests made plans to kill Lazarus as well. For on account of him, many of the Jews were going over to Jesus and believing in him.
All right, thank you, Alec. Just as a recap, I guess yesterday's episode, we discussed the sixth out of seven signs in the book of John, the raising of Lazarus from the dead. And there's a long passage preceding this that talks about that. And as a result of that, we pick up today in verse 45 about the Pharisees finally, getting to the point where they've finally decided we have to get rid of Jesus. Like, this has to stop. So I guess that's a little bit of backstory as to where this passage picks up. When we look at these two kind of sections of scripture, do you guys have any verses that you have noticed or that either you didn't understand or intrigued you or were interesting to you?
Yeah, I think the Caiaphas prophecy is interesting, to say the least. Especially the phrase that he did not say these things on his own authority. I just think that it's just this really kind of interesting, not really a paradox, but a dichotomy maybe, of that we always, through the scriptures and through the gospels, we always see the Pharisees as being these bad guys who, while being religious, are also kind of opposed to God. Like, that they're not holy, they're not righteous. But here you see that, like, if it's not under Caiaphas' authority, then whose authority is it under that he's prophesying these true things about what the death of Jesus is going to mean?
Yeah, it seems like, God is using what he's saying, even though he may not quite even understand what he's saying.
yeah, absolutely.
Like, that's what I think about when I looked at, just studying this verse. It seems like Caiaphas' intentions are not holy, but that he's thinking of Jesus as more of, like, an earthly leader, like, his kingdom's here. But really, like, the prophecy's pointing to, like, the true kingdom of heaven, which is not of this world. And so, like, even the words that he says, they are true, but they're not the way that he intended to say them.
Yeah, it's really interesting, if you look right up above that, it says, like, the Pharisees, once they hear about Lazarus being raised from the dead, and it's clearly something that a lot of people saw. It was very public, and they couldn't deny it. And the report of it, right, is spreading out. And so they all come together, and it's interesting their response. I mean, instead of, believing in Jesus, they, throughout the last, probably 5 to 10 episodes, there's been consistent interactions in the book of John in this middle section between Jesus and the Pharisees where they're clearly opposing him. They're not on his side. They're trying to get rid of him. And, you can kind of continue to see that, what are we going to do? Like, they can't, this man certainly performs many miraculous signs. It's like, we can't deny that he's doing all this stuff, mm-hmm. But if he's dangerous, if he keeps going like this, everyone's going to believe in him and the Roman army will come and just destroy us. Mm-hmm. And so they're thinking about a very practical consolidation of the status quo, and keeping any troublemakers from making any changes,
Yeah, and it's very worldly minded that they're interested in preserving Israel and Jerusalem and the temple. Like, that they're not necessarily worried about how they're going to serve God, but how they're serving their nation, I think, is kind of neat in that.
Yeah. Yeah, and I liked you said, Alec, about just the fact that his intentions are not that Jesus is going to die. It's not a religious, he's not thinking of it, he's thinking of it purely in political terms, right? That mm-hmm. if we get rid of Jesus, we can continue living as we have been.
Not as a substitution for ourselves.
Right, not as a way to bring us into some kind of relationship with God or to atone for sin or anything like that. He's just saying, Rome, he clearly, knows Rome has an army and military power that can come out and do whatever they want.
Yeah.
And he's thinking purely of just maintaining the status quo. But it's interesting that John keeps, saying, he didn't say this on his own. Like, he, mm-hmm. the way he meant it was not the way God meant it, And I think that is a really interesting observation that you made, that it's like, he's not thinking about Jesus as the true Savior, but what he's saying still points to that, you know? It's like, you can't, even if you're an enemy of Jesus, you still can't really not point to his glory in some way, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's cool? Truth. Well, it's just truth. You can't run from the truth. You can deny the truth, but you can't run from it.
Yeah. I think that's just a crazy... There's a story in the book, I think it's in the book of Esther? There's a character who builds gallows for Mordecai.
What's his name?
Haman?
Haman. It's Haman.
And he wants to get rid of Mordecai, and then, you know, obviously the story kind of inverts where Mordecai is exalted and gets glory, and then Haman is hung in his own gallows.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of an interesting... It kind of reminds me of this kind of passage where Caiaphas is... you know, saying something from a certain point of view, but the person he's really trying to destroy is really the one that's, there's going to be this flipping of that script where Jesus is exalted and he is de-exalted. I guess, I don't know what word I should use there, but it's, I think that's just such a cool, God is using even the enemies, right, to advance his kingdom. And that's just such a cool, like, clever, awesome, wise thing to see.
And also, like, it shows God's sovereignty in going to the cross. Like God was in control of the whole thing.
Yeah, it was planned from the very beginning.
Like, that's why Jesus knew the hour that, like, he consistently says, and like, especially in the Gospel of John, like, this is not my hour, like, my hour is not yet come. Because he knows the exact time of when this is going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's, the whole time he's been... One of the interesting things about just doing this and reading through sections of John, you see how many references there are to the cross all over the place. It's just everywhere. From the very first, you know, chapter, John 1:12 says, "But his own did not. He came to those to the world he created, but his own did not receive them." That's a very kind of loose, I guess, paraphrase. But even that first verse, right, is like these are the people who they were his own, and they're rejecting him, and they're going to kill him. You know, and throughout the whole book, there's just continued references. Jesus is, like, telling anyone who really can pay attention and discern that he's going to die, you know? Mm-hmm. And we're finally getting to the point now where his enemies have finally... They've been kind of hedging and been kind of afraid because the crowds are very pro-Jesus and they don't want to upset the crowds and they're afraid of the crowds. But now, once he raises Lazarus, they're finally like, it doesn't matter anymore. We got to get rid of him. And it's, like, the kind of turning point where it's, like, you know, verse 53, it says, from that time on, the Jewish leaders began to plot Jesus' death. You know? It was like, that's what they were going to do.
Yeah, like, this sealed, like, the death warrant for Jesus. And, like, that's just so cool. Like, that, like, obviously, like, this is from God, and God's, like, sending out the death warrant on himself. Like, that's just crazy, like, to think about. And it was all for us.
Yeah. The next story is kind of another interesting, I guess, considering these themes of Jesus' death and the cross. There's this interaction with Mary and the perfume. There seems to be, I guess, one of the things I found interesting about this is the disciples don't really get it that Jesus is going to die, but this whole interaction with Jesus and Lazarus and now with Mary, you know, in yesterday's episode, we talked about this where Jesus has some run-ins with the Pharisees. They're going to stone him. He leaves. And then when he hears Lazarus is sick, he goes back, basically, to the scene of the crime. And Thomas and some of the other disciples are like, Rabbi, they're going to kill you if you go back there. You know, why are you doing that? Mm-hmm. And then they kind of understand that, like, for Jesus to raise Lazarus from the dead meant that he had to, you know, that he was going to die. And slowly there are a few characters that are starting to realize that Jesus is actually going to die. And one of the first people to realize that, I think, is Mary, who is Lazarus's sister and was around for this whole thing. And the reason she's doing this is, you know, because Jesus says, you know, in verse 7, she did this in preparation for my burial, you know? Mm-hmm. And the fact that Mary took this really expensive perfume and put it on Jesus' feet is just a crazy, I feel like, she knew what was going to happen, you know, and she had the insight to give a gift to Jesus before she knew he was going to die. And I think that's a pretty cool thing for, you know, like the fact that she both understood what was going on and then gave an expensive gift, you know, seems just astounding to me. Because nobody else has really understood.
Yeah, to think about, like, how poorly, like, Jesus' body was treated during the crucifixion. Like, how gruesome that, like, whole process was. And, like, to think that, like, this expensive perfume was, like, just used on him. And then, like, going to the crucifixion, like, how gruesome that was on his body. Like, it's, like, wild to think about the difference of, like, how, like, people that loved him treated him versus how people that hated him treated him. Like, they're just so polar opposite that, like, people are willing to, like, pour this perfume on him, but then, like, the opposite end of people, like, hung him on a cross, and that was, like, the worst possible thing, so.
No, you're right. There is a, that difference is pretty stark.
Yeah.
It's also interesting. It says she anointed Jesus' feet. Which, a couple episodes in the future, we're going to, in the next chapter, you read a story about Jesus washing his disciples' feet. Mm-hmm. And the idea that Jesus, like, that Mary is wiping his feet and, like, pouring the perfume on the feet and wiping his feet with her hair, it's just kind of makes me feel a little awkward, you know? Like, it's a super intimate thing.
Yeah.
And it's like, touching dude's feet, like, that's not a thing.
And they were probably gross. Let's
not, I mean, yeah, but, like, you know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
I don't, if I might, like, if I give Tessa, like, Tessa's probably the only person in the world that I could give, like, a foot massage to, right? And it wouldn't be super, super, super weird, right? Like, super weird. And here you have this interaction where it's, like, she fully out there in her love for Christ, and it's, like, intense, you know? It's just a high-intensity scene. And it says the house was filled with the fragrance, you know, like, it filled up the entire space. Like, her love filled up that entire space.
Yeah, I think, too, that this example of Mary is helpful, practically speaking, for, like, how are we as Christians financially, how are we supposed to relate our faith, our finances, to the glorification of God? And, like, Christ, like you know, giving money to this or that cause is, like, not the only way that you can glorify God. I mean, like, practically speaking, I don't know what other ways there are, but I think that Christ there, like, leaves open, like, that these, you know, like, there's not just these three channels by which you can put your finances in to, like, to glorify me, but there are other ways.
Yeah. Well, and it was a year's wages, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So...
Mm-hmm.
The footnote says 300 denarii.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my translation.
Denarius was equivalent to a laborer's full day's wage. So if you figure, like, I guess in today's dollars, right, if you make 10 or 12 bucks an hour, right, is what minimum wage. So let's say, like, 100 bucks a day times 300 is 30 grand, you know? Mm-hmm. It's, like, a non-trivial amount of money, right?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, to spend on a 10 or 15 minute thing, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's extravagant, you know, it's like luxury, it's, you know, and she brings it to Jesus, and, you know, you can see even in the reaction of Judas, right, what he says, it's like, why are we wasting this, you know,
mm-hmm.
And, you know, what some people consider waste is what Christ considers, you know, like, reverent worship, you know?
Yeah, and, you know, like, that's us as Young Life leaders, we get that all the time from our college age friends who are, they're wondering why, you know, we're going to the high school or the middle school and spending time with kids half our ages, like, and it's like, it's, we love the Lord, and this is what he's called us to do, is to proclaim his goodness to our friends in the high school, and I can speak for myself, like, that's how I find my truest form of worship is,
mm-hmm.
is through spreading the good news of Christ to those who need to hear it.
Yeah.
I would have exponentially more money if I wasn't a Young Life leader.
Yeah.
I have so much more money. And I don't have a lot as it is.
Yeah, 5 gas tanks a week is...
Yeah. Well, and I think that college is a time where, you know, you're kind of told where, like, you have finally... like, the keys to your own life, and you can do whatever you want.
Yeah, these 4 years are about you, which is just, like, not true at all.
Yeah.
Like,
Yeah.
Right? Our lives are never about us. Like, you know, like, because of what Christ is doing, what he's preparing to do here, like he bought them. Like, they're not ours, right? Like, and Paul gets into that later on, but that's kind of outside the scope of these 15 verses in John. But
yeah. No, you're right. I think we can worship in a lot of ways. And I just find it fascinating, too, that, like, even all the stuff we do, you know, even the ministry you guys have done through Young Life, the stuff that Park Street does, that the church supports, right? Like, at the pinnacle of all that stuff is, like, Jesus. Our love for Jesus is what the first primary thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
And all the other stuff comes as a way to try and give him a gift or give him glory. You know, not to do stuff for the sake of doing it, but right, but just to try and honestly, you know, love Jesus the way he loves us, you know, and have that kind of purity of relationship is, like, to me, really, when you see somebody, an example of somebody who does that, I think it's really unique and really cool, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, and like you brought up John 13, how Jesus washes the disciples' feet, and this is like the flip around of that.
Mm-hmm.
Which is really interesting. It's after this, but you see, like, is it Mary? Mary's the one that washes his feet, or
she's the one who pours the
perfume. Nard. And so Jesus sees, like, his servant, like, because we're servants of Christ. He sees his servant washing his feet, and then he takes, like, the posture of a servant and washes his disciples' feet.
Mm-hmm.
And so he, like, flips the script.
Yeah,
like, what God would come down and condescend himself to, like, that status of Mary wiping her feet with, or wiping his feet with her hair, and he does that on his hands and knees.
Yeah. No, that's really cool. I just still keep coming back to the fact that Mary seems to understand what's going on. Verse 8 says, you know, you will always have the poor among you, but you will not always have me. You know, it says, the beginning of this says it's 6 days before the Passover celebration, right? And it's like the last week of Jesus' life.
Mm-hmm.
And he's really aware of, you know, the time that he has left. And the fact that Mary understood that and was like, this was her last real, as far as she knew, right? I don't know if she had the insight to know about the resurrection or anything that would happen after this, but, you know, like, this is like her last
hurrah.
Yeah, like her last ability to give something to Jesus. And she took full advantage of it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope that for, you know, in our lives and the lives of, you know, people at Park Street, that we view our relationship with Christ like that, you know, like that that the goal is to give him the gift and to give him the, you know, the proper honor and respect that he deserves. So
yeah, I'm just kind of stuck on the feet thing. Like, just that she, like, perfume on his feet, like, just like how wild that is. And like, they walked everywhere, like, his feet would have been so gross, you know. And like, on those same feet he's gonna walk, like, to the cross. Like, I don't know, that's just, like, wild to me. That, I don't know, I'm just, like, super stuck on that for some reason. But it's just crazy to think about, like, the whole, like, year's wage for that moment. And it was worth it.
Yeah.
Like, so cool.
Can we talk about Judas a little bit?
Talk about Judas?
Yeah.
All right, talk about Judas. Let's talk about Judas.
Yeah, it's just like John, you can tell how John feels about Judas in this. Like, Judas wasn't saying this because he cared about like, poor people. He cared about it because this was money
yeah.
that he could have stolen from. Like, but, like, all the while, like, you know, Jesus is welcoming Judas in his inner circle. I mean, he's one of the 12.
Yeah.
And, like they had this whole long relationship before this for several years. And, like, all the while, like, Jesus knew what Judas was going to do.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I just think that's just interesting to me.
Well, and like the Caiaphas thing, right? That Caiaphas was saying these words out of a certain motivation and mindset, and God was using them for a certain different motivation. You know, Judas was doing what he was doing out of a certain motivation, but Jesus knew and trusted that God was going to use what Judas was going to do, and he was going to turn it into something good, you know?
Mm-hmm.
He he knew that he came to go to the cross, like, you know, like you said before, and, you know, that was the method that he knew was how it was going to happen. And he does, it is, that's a good point, Reed. Like, he's still, like, if you knew somebody was going to betray you to that degree ahead of the fact, how would you treat him, you know? And like you said, Jesus is still, he's still right there up to the end, you know? Jesus didn't kick him out or, you know, get upset with him or whatever. You know, he's still there. Well, guys, I appreciate you doing this recording with me. Thanks for your insights and time and friendship. And thanks to anybody who's listening. We appreciate you guys listening to these and trying to read and reflect on Scripture with us through the season of Lent. So thanks for listening, and we will see you tomorrow.